Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah. كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran rejects as baseless accusations the U.S. has leveled against Tehran to justify its recent attacks on the Iraq-Syria border. The White House says President Biden has long felt the war in Afghanistan cannot be won militarily after American forces leave Bagram Air Base near Kabul. Also ahead, Canada puts its military on standby to help evacuate towns threatened by wildfires amid an unprecedented heat wave. World news from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, Iran has strongly condemned the recent U.S. airstrikes on Iraq and Syria, dismissing the accusations Washington leveled against Tehran to justify the attacks. In a letter to the President of the United Nations Security Council, Iran's ambassador rejected the accusation that the U.S. launched the airstrikes to prevent attacks by Iran or Iran-backed groups on U.S. interests. Majid Takhtaravanchi said such allegations are completely baseless as Iran has never been directly or indirectly involved in any armed attack on American personnel and facilities in Iraq. The ambassador also rejected the arbitrary interpretation of the UN Charter by the U.S. to justify its illegal airstrikes on Iraq and Syria. He slammed Washington for breaching the sovereignty of the two Arab countries, saying the U.S. will fail in its attempt to cover up its destabilizing moves. Political analyst Tony Gosling believes that Washington is after intimidating forces fighting U.S.-sponsored Takfiri terrorists by airstrikes on Iraq and Syria.
ISIL is a U.S.-sponsored, NATO-sponsored force, as was Al-Qaeda. These are just another prong in the tripod, if you want, that the devil is pointing towards the Middle East from the United States, from Britain, from Israel, which is to destabilize the region. They want to balkanize that region. They want to redraw boundaries because their attitude is that unless you do as we say, as they've done, you know, I think over most of, they've attempted to do anyway, over most of the Eurasian continent, if you don't do as we say, we're going to just cause trouble for you. And this is all really just intimidation tactics, nothing to do whatsoever with international law. I cannot see how they could possibly manage to persuade anybody in the Western press that this is in order to block Iranian influence somehow, because there doesn't seem to be any real direct link between Iran and the people that the Americans are trying to attack in Syria and Iraq. To me, I mean, as a Western journalist, I'm particularly disgusted by the way that the Americans, can continually get away with these sorts of accusations, even at the UN Security Council, saying that this is somehow within the constraints of the UN Charter, because they're trying to defend themselves. Seems absurd to me.
July the 3rd marks the anniversary of a deadly US attack on an Iranian passenger plane. The US shot down the airliner over the Persian Gulf after it took off from Bandar Abbas International Airport. All the people on board the plane were killed in the tragic incident more than three decades ago. The US has refused to acknowledge any wrongdoing.
The US brought on one of the deadliest disasters in aviation history 33 years ago on July the 3rd by shooting down an Iranian passenger plane. Iraner Flight 655 was en route from Tehran to Dubai. It was on its usual path when it was shot down by the U.S. Navy's guided missile cruiser, USS Vincennes, killing all 290 passengers and crew members on board. 66 children were also among the victims. The then U.S. administration claimed that the crew of USS Vincennes had identified the Iranian Airbus A300 as an attacking F-14 Tomcat fighter. Vincennes was traversing the Strait of Hormuz inside Iranian territorial waters, and at the time of the attack, Iraner Flight 655 was within Iranian airspace. Tehran declared the incident an international crime. It said even if the warship crew had mistaken the Airbus for an F-14, the tragedy was the result of the U.S. Navy's negligence and reckless behavior. Iran took its case to the International Court of Justice. But the case was settled out of the court in 1996 when the U.S. agreed to pay compensation. Washington maintained that the compensation was not a legal duty and was only based on an ex gratia. Although U.S. officials claimed the attack was a mistake, they never apologized to the Iranian nation and even awarded USS Vincennes commander Captain William Rogers. He was awarded the Legion of Merit decoration for what was described as exceptionally meritorious conduct in the performance of outstanding as the commanding officer of the Vincennes. The citation made no mention of killing innocent civilians on Iraner 655. When the matter was taken to the United Nations Security Council in July 1988, then the U.S. Vice President George H.W. Bush defended the Vincennes crew's action. He said, given the situation, the officers in question had acted appropriately. Bush noted, "I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are." Succeeding American officials took the same approach. Over three decades on, still no justice for the victims of the one of the deadliest incidents in aviation history.
The Russian military says terrorists are planning a false flag chemical attack in Syria's Idlib province. The Russian Center for Reconciliation of the Opposing Parties in Syria said the terrorists have delivered 10 barrels of toxic substances to an area near the village of Harim. It said terrorists and white helmets, a group operating under the guise of aid work in Syria, have been involved in the delivery. According to the report, the terrorists are planning to blame the Syrian government for the attack. Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since 2011. Damascus says Israel and its Western and regional allies are aiding the Takfiri terrorist groups that are wreaking havoc in the country. The White House says the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan is expected to complete before a September 11 deadline.
On Afghanistan, the president said earlier he does not think the drawdown will be done in a few days. The Pentagon has said it's ahead of schedule of the September 11th date. So what is the latest date that the White House is looking at right now?
Well, we currently expect it to be completed by the end of August. As you know, the president decided to withdraw remaining U.S. troops from Afghanistan and finally end the U.S. war there after 20 years.
The White House spokeswoman said President Joe Biden has long felt the war in Afghanistan cannot be won militarily. She added that some Afghan translators cooperating with the U.S. military will be relocated. relocated to outside the country. The Pentagon has confirmed the transfer of the Bagram base to Afghan forces, but it says the U.S. military retains what it calls the authority to protect Afghan forces.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the U.S. military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what U.S. President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all U.S. forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The U.S. and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion failed to approve the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to U.S. media reports, more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which although failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
Turning to some coronavirus news now, Australia's New South Wales state has recorded its biggest daily rise in infections this year. Sydney, the state capital, has been hit hardest in a flurry of outbreaks of the highly contagious Delta variant around the country over the past 2 weeks. New South Wales reported over 65 new cases in 2 days, taking the tally under the current outbreak to more than 250. State officials have warned that the next couple of days will be critical in terms of infections. This comes as Sydney is halfway through a two-week lockdown. Authorities say it is still too early to make a decision on whether to extend the lockdown. Canadian authorities are set to deploy military aircraft to help evacuate towns in danger of wildfires fueled by an unprecedented heat wave in the country. Officials say the armed forces have already been positioned in different regions for logistical assistance. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has also pledged support for the affected areas. The record-breaking temperature and wildfires have resulted in the forced evacuation of several cities in British Columbia in the past 2 days. Medical experts say the unrelenting heat has largely contributed to the growing number of sudden deaths in western provinces. More than 100 wildfires are burning through the region. Officials have warned about flooding from melting mountains in the west and new heat waves moving towards the central areas. Now, at least 200 IT management companies in the United States have come under a massive cyber attack. Huntress Labs, a cybersecurity firm, says the ransomware attack targeted a software supplier called Kaseya in the state of Florida. The hack then spread through corporate networks using the software. Huntress Labs says it believes Russia-backed hackers are behind the breach. The U.S. Cybersecurity Agency has announced that it is taking action to deal with the situation. Ransomware attacks typically involve locking away data in systems using encryption while making companies pay to regain access. Back in December, federal agencies, including the Treasury, State Defense, Energy and Commerce departments, were targeted by unknown hackers. Then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed Russia, but Moscow rejected the accusation. More bodies have been recovered from the ruins of an apartment building that collapsed more than a week ago in the U.S. state of Florida.
Over the course of today's search, we did recover 2 additional victims. We now have 22 confirmed deaths, 188 people accounted for, and 126 unaccounted for.
The mayor also said she has signed an emergency order to demolish the remains of the building to ensure the safety of the search and rescue operation. The worries about the stability of the still standing part of the tower paused search efforts on Thursday amid rough weather conditions. The Champlain Tower's south high-rise partially caved in on itself in the town of Surfside near Miami. The cause of the incident has not been determined yet. Initial attention has focused on structural deficiencies described in a 2018 engineer's report. Top UN officials warn the Security Council of worsening famine and a risk of more clashes in Ethiopia's volatile Tigray region.
One of the most distressing trends is an alarming rise in food insecurity and hunger due to conflict. More than 400,000 people are estimated to have crossed the threshold into famine, and another 1.8 million people are on the brink of famine.
Raja Singham told the council that the humanitarian situation in Tigray has worsened dramatically in recent weeks. He said the number of people suffering from famine has now risen by nearly 50,000. According to the official, 33,000 children are severely malnourished. Tigray has witnessed fighting between government forces and regional leaders since late 2020. The fighting has killed thousands of people and displaced many more. The defense team of Nigeria's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Sakzaki, has adopted its final address to a Nigerian high court, submitting that there's no case against the Muslim cleric. The Jum Abdullahi has more from the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army. The
prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, we address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters.
Benjamin Abdullahi, Kaduna.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
European officials and human rights groups warned the UK's right-wing government is on the brink of violating the Geneva Conventions if it follows through with a plan to open up an offshore hub where refugees will be sent if they attempt to enter the country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading UK Ways Shockingly Cruel Plan to Detain Refugees in Offshore Holding Centers. Stay tuned for more. European officials and human rights groups warned the UK's right-wing government is on the brink of violating the Geneva Conventions if it follows through with a plan to open an offshore hub where refugees will be sent if they attempt to enter the country. Home Secretary Priti Patel plans to introduce the Nationality and Borders Bill, seeking to enable the government to send asylum seekers to an offshore location in Africa for processing. The Home Office is reportedly in talks with Danish officials regarding possibly sharing a processing center following the passage of a similar law in Denmark this month. European Commissioner for Home Affairs said in a statement after Denmark passed its law that the system aiming for external processes outside the EU instead of protecting the right to apply for asylum in the EU would send a strong and wrong signal to the outer world. The planned British legislation is designed as a deterrent for refugees who try to travel to the UK, according to inews.co.uk, and will involve deporting people who enter Britain without the right paperwork to the European countries through which they traveled. Amnesty International UK called Patel's planned legislation an unworkable attempt to avoid the country's duty to refugees under international law and a shockingly cruel approach to people seeking asylum. The UK receives very few people seeking asylum, and yet the government continues this utterly reckless discussion about finding another country to carry out its responsibilities, said Tom Davis, the organization's refugees campaign manager, adding, if true, this move would be extremely damaging and will give a green light to other countries to also shirk their responsibility. The non-profit advocacy group Refugee Council called the offshore processing scheme an act of cruel and brutal hostility towards vulnerable people. Through no fault of their own, they have had to flee war, oppression and terror, said the group, which supports thousands of refugees in the UK each year with legal advice, mental health counselling and integration into their new communities. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has decried the country's so-called refugee crisis despite receiving far fewer asylum applications than other European countries like France and Germany and being home to only about 1% of the world's refugees. Johnson is reportedly supportive of Patel's plan after about 5,600 asylum seekers crossed the English Channel so far this year. In February, journalist Andrew Connolly wrote at Foreign Policy that Patel and Johnson have sought to create a refugee crisis in the absence of an actual problem for the benefit of the right-wing press and government. Faced with a modest trickle of rickety boats washing up on British shores in the months before Brexit and since, Britain's government has begun to stoke an ugly culture war by linking asylum with danger and chaos, Connolly wrote. For a country that seeks to rebrand itself post-Brexit as an outward-looking champion of the rules-based international order, and a prime minister who seeks to distance himself from the recently unseated US president and his xenophobia, it is a parochial and authoritarian run. Amnesty International UK recently demanded British officials stop Patel's plan from coming to fruition and ensure the country meets its obligations to receive refugees. Davies said ministers must put an end to this and instead commit to ensuring that people who seek asylum in this country are properly supported and their claims dealt with fully, fairly, and efficiently. of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
U.S. cruiser Vincent. Bandar Abbas Airport, 9:30 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai were waiting to board the plane. A child asked her mother how long it would take to fly between Bandar Abbas and Dubai. Her mother said, less than an hour. The flight was scheduled to depart at 10 a.m., but the travelers were informed that the Airbus A300 flight had been delayed. 274 passengers and 16 crew members, 290 people in total. Persian Gulf, near the Strait of Hormuz, 7:45 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. One of the helicopters of the U.S. cruiser, Vincennes, reports that Iranian boats are hovering around a German cargo vessel. The Vincennes cruiser moves quickly towards the German cargo vessel without being asked.
We remain alert and we'll stay alert. But at the same time, I don't want to ever give the impression that we're leaning forward on our toes to get a major conflagration started here. That's not the case at all.
The war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started on the last day of the summer of 1980 against Iran entered its eighth year. Throughout these years, the Iranians wanted to put an end to the war through winning the land war.
from the second year of the war onwards. They had been always far superior to the Iraqi army on the battlefield, after being surprised by the beginning of the war. Operation Karbala 5 took place in early 1987. At the end of the bloody Operation Karbala 5, Iran had a superior position and was able to penetrate through the defensive line of Shalamcheh. The progress of Iranian forces towards Basra resulted in significant outcomes. The United States sent the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy to the Persian Gulf to prevent the defeat of Iraq and the fall of Basra. Die Welt and Spiegel wrote that the United States was ready to fight Iran with 6 battalions in 600 warplanes in the event of the collapse of Basra. The Soviet Union also expressed its concern over the continuation of the war and stressed that the war had to be eventually ended with negotiated settlements. Perhaps the Iranians will never forget the statement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger said, "Iranian people should be exterminated by cutting off Iran's oil production so that the war will be over." And years later, Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, wrote in his memoirs, "Following the adoption of Resolution 598 in July 1987, the United States definitely believed in order to end the war, 1. The Iraqis had to firmly stand against Iran's victory. 2. The war had to be more painful for Iranians than any other time. 3. The flow of weapons to Iran had to be reduced through another resolution within the Security Council. And 4. There had to be a great deal of international pressure on this country." In 1987, the Persian Gulf was the scene of the confrontation between Iran and the United States of America, in which many heartbreaking and painful incidents took place. In the spring of 1988, Iran was going through a tough situation. After the fall of Al-Fah, the U.S. government announced that it would support not only Kuwaiti and Saudi ships, but also other countries' ships and, in general, shipping in the Persian Gulf. They officially announced that all Iranian leaders had to know that the continuation of attacks in the Persian Gulf would not be tolerated.
On the morning of July the 3rd, we were coming back through the Straits of Hormuz on the way to pick up another ship for an Ernest Will escort mission. And there was some radio communications indicating sounds of explosions or such coming from Montgomery and Vincennes.
German merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We are standing by channel 1-6, over.
Okay, 1-6. Do you read me?
Merchant Beulah Gary, this is U.S. Navy warship. We'll meet you loud and clear, over.
Okay, thank you.
On the morning of July 3rd, Captain McKenna, chief of the U.S. Naval Operations Center, was startled to discover that Vincennes' cruiser had moved away about 64 kilometers from where it was supposed to be. Then he promptly ordered Vincennes and Montgomery back south to their original location.
It was our concern, however, that Vincennes was acting in an overly aggressive fashion, or so it seemed, and that they were actually pursuing these boats rather than being pursued by them. The IRGC were sort of a ragamuffin band, if you will. I mean, they were not very well coordinated, and certainly it wouldn't be too difficult to scare them, I don't think, into doing something that was foolhardy. If they saw a lot of military machinery bearing down on them, they could easily become frightened. It was our business out there to defend shipping against those guys, but not to provoke them. We don't know how close to the boats the helicopter actually went. There was, without getting too technical, a fixed distance that they were supposed to maintain. If, in fact, they were harassing the boats, which may have been the case, how would the boats communicate with them? Well, they would generally fire warning shots. We'd seen that happen with news helicopters there in the past. If the news helicopters or the media helicopters got too close to Iranian small boats, bog hammers, if you will, or whatever, warning shots would be fired and had been fired in the past.
An American helicopter pilot informed William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, that Iranian gunboats had fired at his helicopter. Rogers ignored the return order, moved towards Iranian territorial waters, and convinced Captain McKenna to authorize him to shoot Iranian boats. At 9:49, the Vincennes opened fire on Iranian boats.
Shots, or were they actually attacked? The helicopter wasn't hit, after all, and the helicopter could escape the area at great speed, and in fact it did. So therefore, what was Vincennes up to in going to general quarters, accelerating to maximum speed, and heading off to those boats, which at the time presented no threat to anyone?
I did not send the Vincennes to support the Montgomery. I authorized the Vincennes to send their helo. I was the only one that was in authority to send them anywhere, and my understanding was that they had asked permission to cover the area with the helicopter, and that they were also told to remain on station. Eichmann at the time specified, and they were very clear-cut, that you will return fire with fire, and so they asked permission to take the units under fire. I gave permission and reported the same to Commander of Mideast Force.
In Bandar Abbas Airport, 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai boarded the plane so that pilot Mohsen Rezaian and his colleagues would fly them to Dubai. The Airbus, a passenger plane, took off at 10:16 after a short delay and was supposed to land at Dubai Airport in 28 minutes.
During that engagement with the small boats, the aircraft lifts off from Bandar Abbas and then proceeds on course, essentially, slightly off schedule, as has been noted. I think they were 20 minutes or so behind schedule, climbing on a fixed course, using the proper IFF and so forth and so on.
The Vincennes sailed into Iran's territorial waters in pursuit of Iranian boats by 10:22. And violated maritime law.
Officer Deck, presently hold the ship, crossing the Iranian declared war zone line.
We did take the 12-mile limit seriously. Everybody was very concerned about it. Incurring into the 12-mile limit was verboten, and people were supposed to hold short of this 12-mile limit by several miles to prevent that from happening.
The aircraft was proceeding on a course that would take it directly over the Vincennes position. Recall again that Vincennes was in the middle of a gun battle with these small boats. Now, perhaps a battle of its own making, but firing nonetheless.
When I briefed in with the commander of the Mideast Force, I know that a very serious concern of his, as a matter of fact, he said, Dick, the one thing that I am concerned about is shooting down a civilian aircraft.
The Iranian passenger plane was ascending when the Vincennes crew saw it on the radar screen. The Airbus A300 passenger aircraft did not look like the F-14 Tomcat. A passenger plane is much larger compared to a fighter plane, and it also flies slower. However, the Vincennes crew believed that they had mistaken this giant plane for a tiny F-14 Tomcat.
I was told that it was an F-14. I watched it. I took a look at its altitude and its speed. It was climbing. It was slow. It was in the middle of our missile envelope. The F-14, to my knowledge, had no significant anti-surface warfare capability, so I designated this thing in my own mind as a non-threat. Captain Rogers, on the other hand, involved with his gun battle at that time, announces that he is intent on taking that aircraft out at 20 miles. It's climbing. It's slow. It doesn't respond. It's in the middle of our missile envelope, basically. It's vulnerable. Why would this aircraft present a threat that did not meet any of the threat parameters that were? If Captain Rogers believed it was a military aircraft, and if he believed, as we think he did, that it was part of a coordinated effort at that point, a coordinated attack, then in his mind, he could see this as a threat.
Tense. It did make the situation much more complicated.
Both ships had attempted to communicate with the aircraft, and we were unsuccessful. We got no response back.
We could hear the challenges go out on military air distress and this civilian version of the air distress channels. So we were aware that they were warning an aircraft, an approaching aircraft.
Typically, if you could not communicate with an Iranian airplane, military aircraft, you illuminated them with your fire control radar, you let them know that you were there, and they would generally depart the area. When we illuminated it with our fire control radar, it didn't react.
And did not have the capability to talk directly to the commanding officer of Vincennes, simply because he was engaged on a very personal basis in a fight. And I knew they were about ready to pull a trigger on a missile that could kill my pilots, and I wanted to make absolutely certain that they didn't become the victim.
Air hostile at 004, true, 21 miles.
The aircraft crosses the 20-mile mark, and he doesn't shoot it down. At that point, I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that, okay, he has now seen that it is a non-threat.
Size is right here.
Size.
Okay.
What I'm told transpired during that period of time afterwards is that they weren't capable of getting the shot off in an orderly fashion. So although the intent was to shoot it down at 20 miles, they sort of bungled the operation.
William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, requested a permission from the command center to open fire on the Iranian fighter jet. The soldiers and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser became increasingly nervous when they heard about a possible attack by the Iranian fighter jet, and fear fell upon them all. The Iranian passenger plane was ascending, though a fighter jet does not need to get high to attack an aircraft, and it is capable of attacking the target so quickly. The passenger plane sent the codes that indicated it was not a fighter aircraft, and they could identify the aircraft based on the communications between the pilot and the watchtower. However, the commanding officer of Vincennes said they received no codes from the passenger plane, so that he decided to shoot down the plane. A few minutes later, 18th minute into the flight, the passenger plane disappeared from the Vincennes radar screen, and the crew of the American cruiser started embracing each other. They did not know that their happiness would soon fade away, and that was the bitterest day of their lives, the bitterness of which would always remain in their minds. A few meters away, there were 108 women and children among the 290 people who were killed. An eyewitness says, while collecting the bodies of the passengers, we saw a woman who had hugged her child. She was hugging her so tight, the baby was stuck in her arms. We would not separate them. A child who had thought it would take less than half an hour to get off the plane at Dubai Airport.
We had individuals who were up in places where they could see wreckage fall and they could see the airplane coming down. It wasn't until sometime later that they described the wreckage in terms that led us to believe that it was not a military aircraft. It was too much, too large.
An Iranian Airbus is presumed crashed. Please look for survivors or aircraft wreckage.
I killed over the entire force. They spent a considerable amount of time. There was nothing there. And it's also fairly ironic that the Vincennes is the one that came upon the wreckage when it started to become apparent that this was an airliner that was involved. It was just a sickening feeling for the entire rest of the day. I can't ever remember being so dismayed, so depressed, so feeling for all of the people that were involved. It it wasn't a very happy day in the Gulf for us, that's for sure. The Sides was dispatched to go close to the Dubai to see if they could find wreckage. And
firstly, the Americans announced that they had shot down an Iranian F-14 Tomcat. And once the truth came out, they claimed that the Iranian plane had deviated from the flight path and had ignored all 7 radio warnings issued from the Bensons. Later on, it became clear that the Iranian plane was ascending along a legal flight path. 4 years after the incident, the New York Times wrote, "It was a Vincent's cruiser that illegally crossed into Iranian territorial waters. However, American officials have covered it up."
After receiving further data and evaluating information available from the Persian Gulf, we believe that the cruiser USS Vincennes, while actively engaged with threatening Iranian surface units and protecting itself from what was concluded to be a hostile aircraft, shot down an Iranian airliner over the Straits of Hormuz. The U.S. government deeply regrets this incident.
Given the threatening flight profile and the decreasing range, the aircraft was declared hostile. Vincennes fired 2 standard surface-to-air missiles, at least one of which hit at an approximate range of 6 miles.
An examination of the events on 3 July leads quickly to the conclusion that Iran must share the responsibility for tragedy and the investigation so found. By any measure, it was unconscionable to ignore the repeated warnings of the United States and permit an airliner to take off from a joint military-civilian airfield and fly directly into the midst of the ongoing surface action in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians themselves had initiated.
The United Nations Security Council, July 16, 1988. An emergency meeting was held at the request of the Iranian representative to the United Nations to review the incident of the passenger plane being shot down. Iran's foreign minister and U.S. representative George W. Bush spoke at the meeting. Bush told Mr. Velayati, "This would not have happened if you had stopped fighting the war." He continued, "Minister, I am telling you that you need to choose between ending the war and confronting us. The war had become painfully torturous for the Iranians, and Resolution 598 was accepted 2 days after the Security Council meeting and the Airbus incident. On July 20th, 2 days after the adoption of the United Nations Security Council resolution on the crash of a passenger aircraft, a resolution was issued. A resolution that only expressed regret about the occurrence of that incident and included a few general statements in its other paragraphs. It also contains some recommendations concerning the prevention of future incidents and supporting research by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Iran simultaneously requested an emergency meeting from the Security Council and asked the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to initiate the investigations. However, the final report of the ICAO was nothing beyond the Security Council's statement. They condemned the incident and offered some ethical recommendations.
Everybody interviewed in the combat center said that the plane was descending toward the Vincennes. But the electronic record shows it never descended toward the Vincennes. But everybody had that view. I mean, they totally deluded themselves as to the nature of the threat.
Later on, Iranians filed a formal complaint with the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The results of the Security Council meeting and the ICAO investigations had already shown that there would be no better ending to this case in The Hague as well.
Perhaps at the time of the ICAO release, we should have declassified the ship's position and issued a press release pointing out Vincennes' location within Iranian waters at the time of firing.
I spent an immense amount of time, probably the bulk of my time, looking at all the tracks and the various documentation that had been done on the tracks, and how uncertain that evidence is.
How do you explain, Admiral, the discrepancy that everything started in response to distress calls, and yet the Fogarty report later confirmed that it turned out that there were no distress calls?
I don't think I can explain, Congressman. I think he misspoke.
Mr. Fogarty?
Yes. I've talked to him about. He doesn't remember. I cannot reconcile at times.
The reason why there was no final report is exclusively my fault. We didn't produce any further document, although we wanted to, and I got bogged down with something else that erupted. I forget what it was. The biggest problem you have in doing any investigation is the guy who commits the mistake, or whether it be an honest error or whether it be a grievous error, lies to his superiors to cover his own butt.
The commanding officer and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser received the U.S. Navy Medal of Honor once they completed their mission in the Persian Gulf. The passenger plane's case was closed after the agreement. However, history still remembers it, and every year people honor the memory of the travelers who never arrived at their destination.
The limelight.
Nearly 500 people may have been killed by record-breaking temperatures in Canada's westernmost province, as officials warned a grim death toll from the heat dome could rise again as more deaths are reported. On Friday, 2nd of July, British Columbia's chief coroner said that 719 sudden and unexpected deaths had been reported over the past week, triple the number during a similar period in a typical year. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Leighton Secco. The piece is titled Record Heat Wave May Have Killed 500 People in Western Canada. Nearly 500 people may have been killed by record-breaking temperatures in Canada's westernmost province of British Columbia, as officials warned the grim death toll from the heat dome could rise again, as more deaths are reported. On Friday, 2nd of July, British Columbia's chief coroner said that 719 sudden and unexpected deaths had been reported over the past week, triple the number during a similar period in a typical year. We are releasing this information as it is believed likely the extreme weather British Columbia has experienced in the past week is a significant contributing factor to the increased number of deaths, the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, said in a statement. The coroner's office said it would typically expect close to 230 deaths in a similar period. The overall total will probably rise after more communities provide data. But the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, said the province has been a promising downward trend in recent days as the heat ebbs and shifts eastward. Officials have cautioned it will probably take months to determine the exact cause of death for hundreds of residents, but they say heat played a significant role in the surge in fatalities, especially among seniors in the province. Many of the deaths experienced over the past week were among older individuals living alone in private residences with minimal ventilation, Lisa Lapointe said in her statement. In a region of the country accustomed to mild summer temperatures, communities were forced to scramble to find ways to help vulnerable residents stay safe amid blistering temperatures. But regional officials are facing growing questions over the response to the heatwave crisis. On Thursday, 1st of July, the head of the province's Emergency Health Service apologized after residents were made to wait hours for ambulances during the worst of the heat wave. Global News reported that British Columbia's Emergency Services Center, which allows paramedics to be redeployed to high-need areas, wasn't activated until after the worst of the heat wave had passed. The weather system that enveloped large swathes of the Pacific Northwest broke 103 heat records across British Columbia, Alberta, Yukon, and Northwestern Territories earlier this week, according to Environment Canada. The heat has done little to help a province already vulnerable to the devastating effects of wildfires. At least two people are believed to have died in a wildfire that destroyed the village of Lytton on Wednesday, 30th of June. Police attempted to search for missing residents, but dangerous conditions have prevented them from entering the community. Late on Friday, 2nd of July, 136 active wildfires were reported in British Columbia, including 9 which were of concern, according to officials. The dry, hot weather is expected to continue for the next week, hampering efforts to gain control over the wildfires.